How has our climate changed over the past quarter century in terms of temperature, flooding, drought, and what's in store for us in the next 25 years? River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa is celebrating its 25th anniversary. So we're taking the opportunity to get an update on the latest research on climate change, also on water quality and availability. My guests, environmental engineer Jerry Schnur. He's been monitoring climate and water availability in Iowa and across the globe for more than 20 years. Also on board this hour, biochemical engineer Greg Carmichael. He's been researching health effects caused by climate change. That's all coming up. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How has Iowa's climate changed over the past quarter century in terms of temperature, flooding, drought? What's in store for us in the next quarter century? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa is celebrating its 25th anniversary. So we're taking the opportunity to get an update on the latest research on climate change, also water quality and availability, with its co-directors from the very beginning of their story at the center at the University of Iowa. My guests, Jerry Schnur, Professor of Environmental Engineering, and Greg Carmichael, the University of Iowa Professor of Chemical and Biochemical Engineering. Jerry Schnur in our Iowa City studio. Hello, Jerry. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben. It's good to be here.
Greg Carmichael joining us by phone. Did I hear you were at NASA today?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Perhaps we'll have a chance to talk about that, because I understand that has the work you're doing with NASA has something to do with air pollution. But let's get in on the ground floor. We want to go back to the founding of your center. Jerry Schnur, take us back to its founding. Why was the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research founded? What was the impetus?
Well, in 1988, there was a testimony by James Hansen, a Triple Iowa graduate, to the U.S. Senate that because the greenhouse gases are building up, carbon dioxide in particular, from burning our fossil fuels, gasoline, natural gas, and so forth, that this was a real threat to humanity in the future. And it generated a lot of publicity, in part because 1988 was a really, really hot year across our nation, and people began to take notice. Against that backdrop, a lot of faculty at the University of Iowa from different disciplines had already been working together and talking about these issues out of concern for the possibility of climate change. All those things came together such that in 1990, some very forward-looking legislators in the State House in Des Moines decided to pass the Iowa Energy Act, which would both address the change of changing climate, the challenge of that, by forming our center, and also the Iowa Energy Center for New Energy Technologies at Iowa State University. So all those things kind of came together at that time to start our center, and we're grateful for that.
Jerry Schnur, you've been monitoring climate and water availability in Iowa and across the globe for more than 20 years. Greg Carmichael, you've been researching, I understand, the health effects caused by climate change. So a quarter century ago, when you and Jerry founded this center, what was the thought there from the health effects side?
Well, what we knew is that, we knew very well established that the burning of fossil fuels and other components were creating air pollutants, and the connection between air pollution and health was solid at that point in time. And clearly, in beginning in the 1970s, lots of laws came into place. But what we were questioning was that as we continue to increase fossil fuels, not only do we have the expected increase in health impacts, but we also know that the same processes are creating CO2. And so we, and myself and others, were interested if we move to a warmer climate, as we're putting more pollutants, we're going to have more air pollution. But is there a feedback effect where these two problems are going to be connected? And we didn't know at that point in time how they're going to be connected. So that was kind of the intellectual connection.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps it's a good time, Greg, to clear this up, because this is often a confusion in this discussion. One, you have pollution, and the other, you have greenhouse gases, CO2. Is there a short way for us to keep that straight?
Yes. I think that the way to think of it is that whenever we burn, let's take coal, for example, we're going to always, if it has any carbon in it, and we're going, that's what we have for fuel, if we're burning it, that's going to, some CO2 will be released. But if we don't convert everything to CO2, there are also other components in there. So at the same time, anytime we burn, we get both always. We get air pollutants and we get carbon dioxide.
Okay. We want to reach out to our listeners this entire hour. Greg Carmichael and Jerry Schnur are with us, co-directors of the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa, talking about climate science, also talking about water quality and availability. We want to field any of the questions that you have about it. We'll get into the science and the perception of the science of it as well later in this hour. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Jerry Schnur, when you think back over the past 25 years, how has the discussion evolved from where you said you started?
In 1990, when the center was formed, I think there was a lot of discussion among the public, the general public, and interest that really trying to figure out, is this a substantial problem and what should we do about it? And most people thought we'd have comprehensive energy and climate change legislation somewhere along the line, let's say in the 1990s or early 2000s, and it never did happen for perhaps various political reasons. Through that time, we've become more and more certain that indeed it is a major threat to the socioeconomic system of humanity, and that there are big repercussions if we allow this to go much further. And people have been, most climate scientists are convinced of that, the great majority. And because of that, I think that the nature of the conversation has changed. The actual estimates of where we're going as a result of our emissions haven't changed all that much through five United Nations reports. But I think the certainty that indeed it's a threat, that really is what has changed. The public, though, went through a period, maybe a low point period, where they seem not to care very much or not to, quote, believe in the science. I think that's changing now again, too.
Mm-hmm.
So today I think there's movement and some coalitions are forming to really begin to do something about it.
Greg Carmichael, comment on that. We have Jerry Schnur saying, you know, we had the science developing, and then in another plane we have public perception going hand in hand with the politics. How would you describe the roadblock that action in reaction to the science that was presented to us hit politically?
Well, I think we're getting this kind of tension because, as Jerry said, the science is getting more and more certain, and I think the message coming that there's more urgency. And in the beginning, if you go back to 1990, the real what the public understood, they kind of got the problem, but everybody was on board that says more research is needed. And I think they all thought to try to solve the problem. But on the other hand, doing research in some camps, I think, was a way to buy some time. But I think now as the research hardens and as the we're seeing more and more the impacts of a warming climate, we're getting closer to having to take an action. And that's where I think there's a lot of movement, but I think the barrier is, what should the U.S. do? What's it going to mean to jobs? And I think those that are dragging their feet are using this why us, why the U.S., why taking action now relative to what may be happening elsewhere. But I think the fact of the matter is most of the other parts of the world are getting off the mark. Europe's been going after this for a long time, but now even China is working on this problem. So those people that are thinking we can't do anything because it may impact us, I think it's turning around at the fact that we're not doing anything is impacting us in a negative way.
We want to talk about the international aspects of this, of course, the coming Paris climate talks, the end of November, beginning of December coming up, the latest attempt by world leaders to forge a deal to overcome what would be the stem the expected effects of climate change. But first of all, I wanted to talk a little bit about the perception here and also the ends of the spectrum, where people find themselves too. We had a Democratic presidential debate on CNN Tuesday of this week. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said this. He said that climate change is the biggest national security threat we face as a country. Here's one of his comments about climate change from that debate.
Today, the scientific community is virtually unanimous. Climate change is real. It is caused by human activity. And we have a moral responsibility to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy and leave this planet a habitable planet for our children and our grandchildren.
Bernie Sanders, just the day before yesterday. Jerry Schnur, is this in any way an exaggeration? He's talking about the habitability of our planet. Could climate science make the Earth uninhabitable for our children?
One of the things that might be lost on most people is that if we don't transition from the fossil fuel age, if we don't move towards solar and renewable energies, wind and energy efficiency or hydropower, if we don't do that, the effects just continue. It's not a 100-year problem. It's not a 200-year problem. It just continues to get warmer and warmer. Clearly, that's not in the feasible set. We cannot go there. So I think Senator Sanders is right with the implications of his remark. And it's not so radical as you might think, Ben. The Joint Chiefs of Staff have said much the same thing in various white papers, that climate change is a threat to humanity and one of our major security concerns.
I wonder, Greg Carmichael, since you look at the health effects caused by climate change, and that certainly ties in with whether this planet will remain habitable in the future, what, from your perspective, would it look like to transition into a planet that is uninhabitable?
Well, I think we don't really want to envision that. I think in a short sentence.
Well, we might need to be scared into action, right?
Yeah, I think so. But, I think what we're seeing is a warmer and warmer. So what we know is that what's happening right now, as we've warmed the climate, even just this little bit that we're doing now, we see the intensity in Iowa of heavy precipitation, the increase in heavy rains and floods and runoffs. We see the droughts in the West. And you can just imagine that, and you see the ice melting, that's going to become the new normal, and that new normal is going to become even more extreme. And so we really don't we have to do everything we can not to go there. What I think is what's possible, though, is because there's more recognition, is coming back to this idea that every time we burn fossil fuel, we're getting both carbon dioxide and air pollutants. And so worldwide right now, just because of air pollution exposure, there's more than 7 million people dying each year due to exposure to air pollution. And that's a huge cost on society. And what's beginning to emerge is that this idea that we can deal with health and climate, there's win-win strategies there, that actions taken right away can save human health and also bias move down and reduce CO2 emissions. So I think that both ends, the climate side and the health side, are coming together to come up with strategies that can allow us to get off the mark in ways that more and more people can buy into.
Jerry Schnur.
I would add that just like Greg said, there's danger associated with our current trajectory, but there's opportunities too. Not only the health improvements that Greg's referring to, but also this is the engine for economic growth in the future. I truly believe that if we wipe out the fossil fuel age and transition into a cleaner energy environment, we'll have clean air, we'll have less asthma for our children, we'll have less emphysema. It'll be a better place to live. And at the same time, will be creating jobs in all of these new
industries.
So this
could be a real economic engine if the U.S. would get out in more in the forefront.
It's an opportunity, yes.
Mm-hmm. Iowa well-placed as one of the leading wind energy producers in the country as well, we have to note here. We just heard Bernie Sanders there with, I guess what I'll say, the doomsday scenario, an uninhabitable planet. And I wanted to look at the other end of the spectrum, well, somewhere to the other side of this thought here. In May, I spoke with our newest Iowa Senator, Joni Ernst, on this show. I asked her thoughts about climate change. She said she was unsure that human activity is causing climate change, and I asked her what it would take to convince her that humans are causing the problem. Here's her answer to that.
Well, again, I think we can go back and forth because I know there are a number of scientists that will also say that, no, the impact of humankind on the global climate change is negligible, especially for countries such as the United States.
But aren't they in just such a tiny minority, and they are not the people who really have to do with climate?
And my question goes back, and I do believe there is climate change. But what if that is the natural course of the Earth? I would go back and say many, many thousands of years ago, before we had humans in an industrialized setting, there was extreme climate changes one direction or another. And it's very cyclic. So with that question being posed, then was that not just a natural occurrence with climate change? Mm-hmm. You know, can we be great protectors of the environment? Certainly we can do that. But I don't want to see it in a manner where the federal government is mandating every aspect of our individual lives. I think that we can take initiatives, especially on our own, that would protect the environment.
U.S. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. Greg Carmichael, does this make sense to you as scientists, also Jerry, who have studied the environment, climate science for decades? Can you hold this position when looking at the consensus among scientists that the negligible was the word that she was used, that the effect of humankind on climate science is negligible, according to Senator Ernst?
Yeah, I think that certainly from a scientific perspective, and again, as Jerry mentioned, this topic has been studied by such a large number of scientists in a very deliberate manner with five large studies. And I think the relationship between human and climate change, that climate change is happening and the human role, is at the same level of confidence that the connection between tobacco smoke and health outcomes. So, I think that denying it from that perspective is, there's other, I think it's really just more tied up in what do we do about it,
Okay, but what you're saying in very diplomatic terms is Senator Ernst has it wrong, dead wrong.
Yes, I think that's it's my opinion, and I think that's the opinion of all the studies and the climate scientists. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about this idea, Jerry Schnur, that she raised as well, that this is the natural course of the Earth's cycles? There's warming periods, there's cooling off periods.
Of course, that's true, but we have no evidence as to why the Earth is warming at current time, other than the greenhouse gas is playing a very major a role in that. And so to Senator Ernst and other people who feel like that, I would simply offer you shouldn't take comfort in the fact that there's been natural changes in the past, because we know for a fact that the greenhouse gases that we're emitting from burning our fossil fuels, our coal, oil, and natural gas, are accumulating in the atmosphere, and that those cause, like a greenhouse, a blanket effect to warm the Earth. So any natural causes that we're not fully aware of and that we don't have evidence for, if they're at play, we're simply adding on to those. And so you shouldn't take comfort in the fact that, well, the climate's always changed. Instead, you should take action at the fact that we're adding to any natural warming that is going on, and the amount that we're adding is quite substantial.
Join our conversation with Jerry Schnur, professor of environmental engineering, and Greg Carmichael, professor of chemical and bio chemical engineering at the University of Iowa. We're talking about climate science, how it's changed over the past quarter century, how our understanding has changed, how public perceptions have changed, how this intersects with the politics of taking some action. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Dan on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Dan.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I guess I kind of wanted to address that intersection that we've been talking about between science and politics and kind of lean towards the political side for a moment. And as a consumer and as an individual who's an environmental enthusiast, I kind of find myself lost on how to take action. And even as a voter, the best way that I could vote for action to be taken from the top down. So I guess what I'm looking for is some kind of scientific support for the best way to take action, whether it be regulating heavy industry, because as, you know, an environmental enthusiast, but as an individual, you know, it takes 7,000 plus gallons of water to process, you know, to process beef, you know, and these kinds of like large carbon emissions that are coming out of factories. It's kind of discouraging as an individual to say, okay, what can I do in the face of this great adversity?
Right, right. Your whatever you could do as an individual, Dan, if I'm hearing you right, is it seems like a pittance.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's get Jerry and Greg to chime in on that. Excellent points, Dan. Thank you in Des Moines.
Thank you.
Well, this is Greg. I think that you do raise an excellent point. I think that, but on the other hand, there is lots that we can do going all the way from the individual to the local to the state, where I think most of the action is occurring right now. You know, I think moving forward to reduce the greenhouse gases, we're going to have to do things like continue to improve our energy efficiency from the, you know, the wind power, the growth of solar power. If we can get more and more to the electrification of our automobiles, and especially if that electrification is coming from electricity that's being driven by non-fossil components. So all the things about at the local and regional, the levels that can be done to do that is, I think, very, very important. So there are things that we can do, and supporting and voting for both elections as well as standards and other components. And then I think in the longer run, I think there's some big policies out there that we will ultimately get to, and, you know, and at the larger scale of trying to put a price on carbon that can make things happen.
Jerry Schnoor.
I would just add agreement with the last thing that Greg said. It's already happening. The cities in particular and industries as well and non-governmental organizations are forming what I call coalitions of the willing who believe this is a problem and that there's opportunity there. They can prosper and profit from the transition that's going to occur. And they're already acting. But in order – the rate that we're improving or the rate that the economy is changing is too slow right now. That's what the models would indicate.
We're making our transition too slowly to avoid
– to avoid dangerous interference with our climate as defined by more than 2 degrees Celsius. That's 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit increase.
Okay. We'll pick this up after a short break. Talking about climate science. Also, we want to chip in water quality here. Ask Jerry about that. It's an area of expertise as well. Jerry Schnoor of the University of Iowa, along with Greg Carmichael of the University of Iowa, co-directors, of the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa, celebrating their 25th anniversary. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. If you've just joined us, you're catching us midstream on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, talking about climate science as the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa celebrates its 25th anniversary, recalling what the science, the perceptions, the thoughts were 25 years ago compared to today, what's changed in the meantime, with co-directors of that center, Greg Carmichael and Jerry Schnoor. Jerry Schnoor, professor of environmental engineering. Greg Carmichael, professor of chemical and biochemical engineering, want to have you join our discussion. Your questions about climate science, perhaps about water quality, availability. There is a tie-in. We'll talk about that in just a moment. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Our email, river2river at iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. When we had to go to break, Jerry Schnur, you were talking about the way to get this changed. You said carbon tax. When we look in the political arena, carbon tax, not something you hear candidates, people wishing to be reelected, using in their stump speeches. But you say that is the answer here.
Well, I think it's an answer. And I wouldn't call it a carbon tax, Ben. I'd call it a fee and dividend. It would be roughly revenue neutral, meaning the federal government would gain no money from it. But the price of fossil fuels would indeed increase through time based on their carbon content and how much emissions. And that would cause that would discourage us to use those. They're not paying for the so-called externalities. They're not paying the true cost of that power. They're not paying for the health effects, the childhood asthma, the emphysema, the cardiovascular disease, the loss of species due to migration and changing climate. They're not paying for any of that. So as we increase their price, the revenues generated from that would be returned to the people. And thus, they could vote with their feet and try to encourage the technologies like solar and wind. Those would get much cheaper at larger scale. And overall, hopefully, the economy would profit from this transition.
Okay. The two of you are envisioning a very green world, also an economically viable, vibrant world for the United States. Greg Carmichael, how do we get from where we are now to there? Jerry listing some of the health effects, which you concentrate on with your studies here. We don't typically count in the costs, the hidden costs that Jerry mentioned. Yeah. Is it a matter of education, realizing that those are costs to our health?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, we do realize it, but I think that it has slowed us down in taking an effect. I think that, and that's why I think this intersection between the recognition of the fact that climate is happening, and even from climate on its own sake, the impacts of climate change, and Jerry mentioned some of them, the additional ones being sea level rise, as other examples, the increase of forest fires and the connections to health. These are all happening, and the urgency, I think, of taking action now is what's emerging. And this idea, coming back to what Jerry said, this fee and dividend, I think is something that, you know, you go back a few years and some of the strongest Republicans were really at the forefront of advocating a plan on putting a price on carbon, and that kind of swayed. But this fee and dividend has been an idea that I think is growing large support.
Bipartisan support, do you think, Greg?
Up to a point. I think where it's derailing a little bit is that I think people are agreeing that maybe a fee on the carbon is a good thing, but from this pool of money of this dividend that Jerry talked about, the way it's envisioned, that it has the most impact is just turn around and give it to every citizen in, you know, in the state, in the country. And so there's no capture by the federal government. But where it's falling apart is the discussion that, well, if I create this pool of money, maybe I could divert it to some other social component. And so so you're really at the discussion of what to do with it, and that's where it's kind of bogging down right now. But again, I think that just in general, moving forward, I think people are just seeing and more recognizing the real costs of happening to us today, and also the, you know, really we're buying in with this problem of climate change is that it's not going to go away quickly. And what we're going to leave is the problem of our kids and our grandkids, and their world is going to be much more impacted than ours. And so I think that there is this understanding and will to begin to say, well, wait a minute, we need to recognize this and we need to take action that there are real costs to society. You know, in China, for example, I talked about the impact of air pollution. You know, they're looking at a loss of 5 years of healthy life. I mean, today. That's a real.
And we're talking about a span of 25 years for your center. But when we trace the Chinese attitude, they've gone through such massive industrial growth here and they've been putting a lot into the air. And that attitude, can you say, Greg, perhaps the biggest change in attitude? Because if you would have gone back 20 years in China, they wouldn't have been too worried about this, right?
No, I mean, their attitude was, and many others, was that you look back and you look at the rapid expansion of the use of fossil fuels and prosperity increased with it. You know, economic development, that was all seen. The more smokestacks, more smoke was really a sign of your economy growing. And a country like China and India, you know, early on in the 90s, one of the arguments was, well, the U.S. and others want us to curb something, but you guys were able to get a free ride on this, and now you want us to do something now when we're growing our economies. But where I think where China's ended up is not for international pressures, but for their own livelihood. They see that the huge impact on human health, the fact that their regional climate has changed, is having a huge impact on their water resources, and they see that they can't go on that way. So they are very quickly progressing to cleaner cities, energy efficiency, increase of wind energy, and they're also taking advantage of leading technologies in these areas. So they see what Jerry talked about is that the opportunities for both their society, but also putting their technology and economic growth on a greener platform is actually a survival path for them and actually a strategic advantage for them.
Greg Carmichael is a biochemical engineer. Jerry Schnur, an environmental engineer, co-directors of the Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa, which has been around as of this week for a quarter century. Join our conversation. Your questions about climate science, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Since we're on the international plane, they're talking about China, November 30th through December 11th, the Conference of Parties in Paris, the latest attempt by world leaders to forge a deal, intending, Jerry and Greg, to avert more heat waves, floods, rising seas. Following the talks similar to this, Copenhagen in 2009. So with that context, Copenhagen behind us in 2009, what is the significance of these talks, Jerry?
I think that the significance is that Copenhagen really was for the purposes of reducing emissions and getting a hard agreement on that, it was a failure. We didn't come away with a treaty or anything that could possibly be taken to Congress, for example, in the United States or any other parliament. However, it was also a starting point in that a new notion that countries could be kept hold their feet to the fire by having made a pledge of what they were going to do and continuously track that through time. Mm-hmm. That's sort of our tack that we're taking right now. So the strategy is each country makes a pledge. We hope that we try to encourage the pledges to become more severe such that it really will make a dent in greenhouse gas emissions and stop this changing climate that we're experiencing. And that's what's coming up in the Paris climate talks as a way to modify the emissions that continuously have grown through this 25-year period. And we need them first to level off. That's a major celebration when and if that occurs. And then second of all, we need them to decline by 80%, if you can imagine, over the next 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So
Great.
That's
mm-hmm.
a complete change in the way we're doing business right now.
Greg Carmichael, as we look to the Paris climate talks in, I guess, about 6 weeks' time, how hopeful are you that this will not end in failure as Copenhagen did in 2009?
I'm optimistic. I think that there is a lot of forward momentum building, and it's coming about by a variety of different ways. But, you know, I'll give the U.S. credit. President Obama has, you know, made this a very big issue in his discussions recently. And also, I mentioned before, China is moving in this direction anyhow. So the U.S. and China, all these kind of national and bilateral sorts of discussions that are promoting one another, endorsing one another, supporting one another in these pledges are it's a much different attitude. I think I'm very optimistic that there's going to be something meaningful out of Paris, and I think a lot of people share that optimism. I think what I would like to see happen is that the climate scientists and others support these people. I think what will probably happen, I think, when we look back at Paris and the ideal world, we'll have a lot of strong pledges. We'll made a great step forward. But as Jerry said, it's probably, more than a baby step, but certainly not a big jump. And we'll need to do more, but we have to start and get people to feel comfortable making these pledges and having multiple countries support one another. So I sense there's some real wind in the sail.
Okay, optimistic. Greg Carmichael, this in the face of news reports that top Republican lawmakers in our country are planning a wide-ranging offensive to undermine the president's hopes of reaching an international climate change agreement. According to reports, GOP strategists there will include what they plan to do. They want to sow doubts about President Obama's climate change policies at home and abroad, try to block key environmental regulations in Congress, challenge the legitimacy of the president's attempts to craft a global agreement without submitting a treaty to the Senate. Both houses in the hands of Republicans with this strategy going on. You can be optimistic, Greg Carmichael.
Yes, because I think I think that the wind is moving. I think that the most important thing from the CO2 perspective is what's happening at global emissions. And, the U.S. is providing some leadership now, but if domestically we throw some other anchors in the ground, but the rest of the world has momentum moving forward, then that's a good thing for the planet, because it really doesn't matter from which country that CO2 molecule is emitted. It has the same impact everywhere. And I do think that, at the national level, the politics is playing out, but I'm pretty confident that, in the back of everybody's mind that this is, once we decide what to do, everybody's got a game plan in play that they'll find a way to embrace this. So, yeah.
Sharon in Johnston is joining us. Sharon, welcome to our program. We've got a few minutes left. Please be brief, but what is your question?
Well, I'm concerned about water quantity and quality for the future of Iowa as we look at climate change, and I was wondering if you could project what your feelings are on that.
Sharon, excellent. I wanted to get to that point, and Jerry Schnur has studied water quality and availability for decades. Jerry Schnur.
We're using output from the climate models right now to try to project out to 2068 for the Iowa Cedar River Basin, what the effects on our water would be. And in general, Sharon, it looks like Iowa will be wetter and warmer. Maybe you could have guessed that, but it's kind of interesting in that globally, to generalize over the whole planet, wet areas are getting wetter. That would characterize Iowa. We're getting it in these severe storms, which are causing flooding and problems. Dry areas are getting drier, like the Southwest United States and California, what we're witnessing right now. And there's some climatological reasons why we think this is true. But in Iowa, at the same time, our projections look like it could be punctuated by droughts occasionally. Hmm. Because as the nights get warmer and there's a low amount of soil moisture in a dry year, it gets drier that much faster. So we see warmer, wetter, but punctuated by droughts. And what's more, because Iowa's economy is actually doing quite well relative to maybe some other places, our manufacturing, our data centers that we're putting in, our biofuels plants, our communities which are growing are pumping more and more groundwater down.
Right.
So it's very surprising to people that here we are in a water-rich state. We've got flooding problems already mentioned by Greg and others, yet we're pumping our aquifers down. So we're,
right, the huge Jordan Aquifer that runs from northwest Iowa down to the southeast. We have
exactly.
We have to keep an eye on that.
I heard your program on that. That was a very good program.
We have to keep an eye on that even when we have flooding. And we think here on the surface we're fine because my backyard is flooded.
Not only keep an eye on it, but I think eventually we'll have to reuse water, treat it very highly, and pump it back down in to restore the aquifers, which we are depleting. And, of course, it's not just Iowa. It's all over the world and all over the country. But, yes, we have a problem with water here.
Related question before we go to our next caller, too. Of course, this country going through a fracking boom. You concentrate on water quality. Do we know, is the jury out on whether fracking will be introducing elements into our groundwater that we don't want?
I think you could do fracking in an environmentally responsible way. I think it is possible. But right now there's not enough regulation and oversight on the quality of the wells, including the drinking water wells in which the aquifers are penetrated that this fracking operation goes into. So my feeling has been that it could be done well, but we're not doing it well right now, and there are impacts on both aquifers and surface waters as a result of this boom, this wonderful increase in energy that we've uncovered does have its environmental implications.
Karen is joining us in Creston. Hi, Karen. You've been listening to our conversation. What's on your mind?
I'm also interested in the water quality. I would like to know what they think about the new Roundup Extend and Enlist Dual that they're testing in Iowa and other Midwestern states, and also about the concentration of the hog confinements and whether they think voluntary self-monitoring works anywhere in the whole world.
Okay. Karen, a lot on your list there. We don't have much time, but I'll ask Jerry, since the water is his area of expertise, to comment, please.
Well, I guess by definition, voluntary monitoring would work if everyone would agree to do something. So far, our record isn't very good. And because of climate change, actually, we're getting more and more runoff of the pesticides that that you're talking about. And your concerns, I think, are well placed. We're going to have to we're going to have to take measures either voluntarily or mandated. In order to improve our water quality, I think it's simply not acceptable right now in the state of Iowa.
Greg Carmichael, before we go, we end the hour. I wanted to ask you about what you're doing right now. You say you're in Virginia with NASA?
Yes, we're getting ready to conduct a big field experiment with NASA aircraft and satellite in Korea and next spring, and that's really focused on looking at our understanding of air pollution and emissions coming off of in East Asia, and also we're putting up some very interesting and very important satellite capabilities to observe greenhouse gases and air pollutants from space, which is really going to open up a great opportunity to monitor CO2 emissions and pollutants everywhere in the world without kind of a scientific rigorous way, and really detect trends, and we can use those to determine, are we really changing, are the emissions changing? And so it's an exciting experiment that we're planning.
Okay. To end this program, I wanted to bring perhaps the biggest skeptic of all here, Rush Limbaugh, saying this week that warnings of the potential effects of climate change are overblown, arguing some that some global warming would actually be good for a lot of things and people. And I bring Rush Limbaugh in here not because he's a scientist. He is not a scientist. And some would say, why would you even mention his name? Well, the reason is, if you didn't know this, he has a lot of ears. He has 13 million ears per well, 26 million. 13 million people listening per week. That is as many as Morning Edition on public radio. So that's why I'm asking you, when Rush Limbaugh, as he did this week, says nobody's even said that we will face an uninhabitable planet, he says this utterly preposterous, that it's all based on bogus, bohunk computer modeling. There's not one shred of scientific data. This is being heard by 13 million people, again, as many as Morning Edition every week. Jerry Schnur, you've got the final word here as I throw that out there.
Well, Rush isn't right. And with the facts, but even with the where the facts would take you, and that is that it's going to be a much warmer planet. we're moving towards loss of all our glaciers. Sea level rise will be a large economic impact. And the fact is that we don't know anything natural that would be causing this, and it can be attributed to human activities for the most part.
And I might just add, would you want Rush Limbaugh to read your CAT scan?
Okay. Okay. Greg Carmichael, thank you for joining us. Jerry Schnur, pleasure to have you both on us on our show, co-directors of the now quarter-century-old Center for Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa. Thank you for catching us up on climate science and with a look back and how it's changed over the past two decades. Greg and Jerry, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.
Tomorrow on this program, it's a News Buzz edition. Included in that, you'll hear part of my recent visit to Fort Madison, where the new Iowa State Penitentiary is. I went inside with producer Emily Woodbury, and we'll, I think, have a visit to the new kitchen. That's tomorrow on this program. Many other topics tomorrow. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News, produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.